This would be Family Law Forum on Early Childhood Issues in a Canyon County meeting. So early childhood issues, let me tell you some history in a moment. In this section on the Family Law Forum, we're going to talk about history of custody of very young children, touch briefly on child development and current research, and then look at best practices for very young children and common parental allegations that you run into. And the last few will be the areas I'll try to spend the most time on, because they're the areas where it gets difficult. Don't know if you realize it or not, but that the custody of very young children has a interesting history. If you were back in the colonial era and there was a divorce of some kind, the children always belonged to the father. Didn't matter what age. So the children were chattel or property of the father, who was likely to be a farmer, and therefore was needed to perpetuate the family subsistence and their family business. So the father, as a parent, was also considered the master of the child, and had no legal rights as a mother to the kid whatsoever, as long as the husband that was divorced, he divorced, was alive. And in addition, if the husband died, she had limited rights. It wasn't like she would now get the kids. In the 1800s, there was a gradual development of divorce in this country, where mothers would have some possible rights to the child, but it was not a lot of legal activity. It was a very much an emerging legal trend that there would be some time given to the mother in allocating time. In the early 1900s through the 1970s, though, the mother was given much more a preference for very young children. When I say very young children, we're talking about 0 to 3, and then also preschoolers 4 and 5. And those were called the tender years doctrines. The tender years doctrine would be that mom was the nurturing parent. You know, she was the one that the child was attached to. She carried this kid, breastfed this child. I mean, if you think about it, in the 40s, 50s, 30s, 20s, you didn't see a lot of baby bottles necessarily, unless there was a real need where they could not have breastfeeding take place. And so the mother became the standard bearer for time with kids for decades. And then I'm just going to pick the 1970s as a time when father's rights began to emerge. They were being ordered to pay child support. They could see the kid maybe once a week. And so they became very strident about dads have rights too. And in that era, there began to be the groundwork for some combination of increased time, maybe equal shared custody, things of that nature, but not necessarily with very young children. In the 1990s, as cases got very complicated, now we have fathers that want to have time and rights, we have mothers that want to have time and rights. Now we have the courts turning really to behavioral health sciences. I've been licensed, I will just say, for a long time. I can tell people it makes me older or wiser. I'll pick wiser. Please don't answer. But I can tell you that I don't recall having any requests for anything resembling a child custody evaluation until the late 1980s. And even then, it was like, well, would you do that? And nobody had a clue what that was. I mean, it really was clinical. Look at this guy, look at this gal, look at the kids. I don't know, take a quarter, throw it up in the air. There really was no guidelines of any kind or really any understanding. And so as we get into the 90s, we now have courts turning to behavioral science people going, what should we do? And that's where we have the emerging field of family law, forensic psychology, and in some states that have a dearth of psychologists or they have different licensing standards, forensic law counselors, social workers, and so forth. Let me put one issue to rest, which I have found to be an Idaho sore spot. I have had more than a few people say to me, well, do you work with master's level people? And what I'd like to say to you with that is, I don't think there's anything about level here at all. I think it's about competence and life experience. I have met people who have a master's degree that will run rings around somebody with a PhD. I've met people who have PhDs who are outstanding, and I've met some PhDs I would not want to have lunch with. So I hope you'll embrace I'm a forensic evaluator and not have any sense of competition or any sense of pecking order. Your work product establishes a pecking order. And there's no reason your product can't be as good or better than anyone that has a few more years of education, period. Make sense? I'm serious about that. Yeah. And the courts, by the way, as well as attorneys, will respond to your work product. If they see that you do a good work product, you'll be plenty busy. If you are a PhD, which I tell people stands for piled higher and deeper, if you are a PhD and you don't do a good work product, you're just going to embarrass yourself. So now we come to the 2000s. There's been now a lot of controversy, especially about infant-toddler overnights allocation of parental time. And you can see the battle lines really coming out historically. Mom's the one that really is a tender one. She's the one that's a nurturer. You know, dad's got scabs in his hands. He doesn't know how to change a 6-week-old infant girl. He doesn't even know whether to go front to back or back to front. And you're going to get this kid sick. And so you have the dad-mom kind of battle lining up against each other. And out of that, people began to do research. Well, one of the areas that they turned to with research is they turned heavily to attachment and bonding. And let me just say this to you. If you really want to get a headache, I defy you to give me an agreed definition of the difference between attachment and bonding.
I heard one.
I know you have, but I want to hear it.
This is as close as I can come yes. that I've heard. It's not yes. my definition. But I have heard from an expert such as yourself that has done national training, but anyway, that children attach and parents bond.
I would say that's inherently flawed. Well, think about it for a minute. First of all, the word parent is elusive. Say you have a child that's delivered and is being put up for adoption. And the next day, the adoptive mother is the person that that child is given to. She's not the parent. See, this is where it gets elusive. She's not biologically a parent. She's a parent figure. She'd like to be a parent. We could go on and on. I appreciate what you're saying. I have definitions of bonding versus attachment. I will just tell you that I don't think you'll find agreement in the field. So you'll have judges order a bonding assessment. They'll do that in some states. We want to do an evaluation of the bonding of this child. Sometimes that's more in foster care or adoption, or they'll want to do one on attachment. So you look at the figures that are well known. You have Conrad Lorenz, who had gooses, little goslings, right? And they would imprint on stuff, people. They'd imprint on his Labrador dog and follow the dog around. So we have here an example of how very, very young organisms will attach themselves or bond to someone. A lot of times bonding would be after birth, you know, sort of what we're saying. Then you have Harlow, and Harlow had his rhesus monkeys, and they found that with the monkeys, that as they were taken away from their parent, and they were given a mannequin to cling to, that they would, in fact, cling to the mannequins now. They were looking for contact comfort somewhere. And if they had a mannequin that had a bottle to drink from, and a mannequin, secondly, that was with terry cloth on it, they would go to the terry cloth one for comfort, but they still go for the one to drink, but come back to the terry cloth. So now the nurturing factor comes into play. And you have Bowlby. John Bowlby, during World War II, did a research study of orphans from the war, and went back 25 years later and found that those orphans under the age of 3 that were placed in stable homes versus unstable homes, the ones in stable homes were doing much better socially, educationally, and so forth. And so it really makes a difference at very tender young ages what happens to a person. Then you have Hubel and Wiesel that did neuropsychology research about the developing brain and how at very young ages so much is really formed in the toddler and infant about their future intellectual development, their social orientation. And then there's an article I think I had, I think you were going to distribute, Mary, by Arredondo. Maybe I didn't. I thought I did have it.
Yeah.
And his point is this, and this is the reason I'm bringing it up, because you will hear over and over again, but this poor little baby, we're going to disrupt the attachment with mom if you have this kid spend time with dad, or some such. The point Arredondo is making is this. This is a bilateral relationship. It's not one way. It's not the kid to the parent. And it's a complex relationship. It's not the kid to this parent or that parent. It's this kid to the world. And it's a reciprocal relationship. And so if you have reciprocal connectedness as your criteria, which goes beyond attachment and bonding, now you're looking more at a real world, real life situation that could have some merit. So as some of you may have seen during the course of a evaluation or a divorce proceeding, maybe dad was very disengaged prior to the divorce action. He was working and he was doing his own thing. Now they're getting divorced. Now he's got the kids umpteen times a week. Now he's really all into it. Guy's bought toys. He's taking them out on walks. Never did that before. He's interacting with the kids. He's loving it. And the mom, she's still being a mom, so she's being fine. But he's, in a sense, really stepped up. The reciprocal connectedness here is going to say a lot more than who was a primary caregiver from 0 to 6 months. I mean, it's just a whole different deal, right? And so the principle here is that history and the attachment bonding theories have really driven a lot of the arguments in court about the allocation of parental rights and responsibilities for very young children. In some cases, even the work of Mary Ainsworth, who has what's called the strange situation problem, is they would take an infant or a toddler, usually 12 to 20 months, put them in a room, and then bring in and take out at various times a stranger to see how they reacted. And they came up with different levels of reaction. This person had disrupted attachment. This person was resistant. This person, and so you had various choices about what would happen. I can't for the life of me imagine any of you or me. I need to find 4 good volunteers, and we need to borrow your baby for half a day. yeah, and just see how it goes. It just would never fly. But they actually have done that in some jurisdictions. And there were some people that got training from Ainsworth to do exactly that for custody cases. So here's the principles. Number one, a stable caregiver is critical for healthy development of a very young child. A stable caregiver. Could be mom, grandma, dad, a foster mom. But if they're stable, that seems irrefutable. Secondly, there can always be more than one stable caregiver. And that's the piece of the equation that gets lost politically. And that's the piece of the equation that's often gotten lost judicially. A father that I have seen up here had 2 very young children in a divorce proceeding. Went to mediation. Well-known mediator in the Treasure Valley. And the mediator looked at him and said, because this guy wanted to have overnights with the young children. One was 1 was 3. Wanted to have overnights. And the mediator said, why would you want to have overnights with them? So, I mean, do you see the thinking? Why would you want to have overnights with them? I mean, why don't you wait till they're 6? I've read consistently in several reports here, research says that they should not have overnights until at least 3, maybe preferably 6. And there shouldn't be 50-50 parenting until at least 6. Research says. Now, mind you, there's not a drop of any research attached to the document. But that mindset is pervasive in some jurisdictions. Young children do not spend overnights. More frequent visits of shorter duration, so you might have 4 days a week, 3 hours, 2 hours, and nothing overnight, nothing prolonged, until a certain age.
And yet if you were married and the mom had to go away for a vacation for 3 days, you wouldn't say, well, I don't think the dad should watch the little ones. You'd say, well, dad's going to watch the kids.
Or how about this? Dad's working, mom's working, they go to daycare for 10 hours.
Yeah.
And it's not stable in terms of the caregivers. So you can see this is a highly emotionally charged issue that becomes very politicized quickly. And when I say politicized, I don't mean the court's political, but the voices are political, and that comes into the judicial system. So principle is that there can always be more than one stable caregiver. Principle is that children are complicated, and that research descriptions, the buckets of disrupted attachment and so forth, these buckets don't reflect life. Life is a spectrum of continuous things. Life is a spectrum. It's on a scale that just kind of varies and runs back and forth. This is why your work is so important and so complicated. you're dealing with stuff where there's very seldom any blacks and whites. There really isn't. And if you've ever listened to a very convincing litigant in your initial interview, and you're thinking like, I gotta fight it, Dad's a scumbag, I've got it, I just don't want to go there yet. And you talk to Dad, and then Mom's really, she's slutty. I don't want to go. I mean, if you aren't careful, you know, you can just get biased very quickly. And that's what can happen in all of this. Kids are complicated, and they're dealing with parents that are going to be complicated. And our task is what? Comparative parental custodial fitness in the best interest of the child. Two parents, what are their strengths? What's the kid's needs? How does it fit together?
Can you say that again?
Comparative custodial fitness and the best interests of the child. That is the task of what you're doing. One of the risks that you have in writing a report, and I know I'm taking a sidestep here, but it happens all the time, and I'm saying this in a way that you would understand and I would understand. When I started to do forensic work civilly, it was coming out of a clinical background, right? So what am I used to? You know, Mom is this, Dad is this, blah, 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 blah. And you end up writing a fairly clinical report. Well, now, as time has gone by and we have better understanding of what we're trying to do, a lot of times you'll see that 85% of the report is the drama and the allegations between Mom and Dad. He said, she said, you know, he is a bum, she's a, you know, whatever. This has been going on for a long time. They can't communicate. And literally, if you get a half a page on what the kid is like and what their needs are, you might be hitting pay dirt. I have a report just like that right now. It's about he said, she said, blah, 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 blah. And I look at the findings, and it's like, why are they doing this modification? Because the mom thought it would be helpful to the kid. What did the kid, and the kid's content is like 3/4 of a page. What did the kid say about any changes? I like it just like it is. What does the mom want? She would like to have primary, but she settled for 50-50. What would the dad like? He doesn't want 50-50, and they never wrote down what he would like. And so what I guess, do you see what I'm getting at? So here, it's complicated, and you've got to remember, I have two parents, I'm looking at their factors, the child's needs, and then how those parents' factors and needs combine in terms of allocation of time and parental rights. And then I want you to remember the medical abbreviation. This is truly a true medical abbreviation.
Is it funny-looking kid?
Yes, it is. You knew it.
I knew it.
Yes. This is a funny-looking kid. And I'll tell it to parents who have, in fact, a funny-looking kid. I said, I'm not trying to offend you, but your kid does not fit a bucket anywhere. You know, they're not pervasive developmental this, they're not ADD. They're honest to God, your kid is a funny-looking kid, and we love your kid. Well, a lot of times in an evaluation standpoint, from an evaluator standpoint, you're looking at funny-looking kids, right? Or you're looking at strongly contrasting kid, quiet, older daughter, you know, very, very hard-working student, very few friends, you know, jock brother, you know, who's younger, who tears down trees with one hand and, you know, runs a neighborhood. It's kind of like, okay, how do we do the comparative custodial fitness on this? Because it's complicated, right? Okay. Moving past the research stuff, I'll touch on this very quickly. Understand that Australia has done a lot of research as a government on very young children and allocation of time and overnights. One of their leading researchers is a woman named McIntosh. They have moderated their tone a little bit as recent years go by, but at one point it was like, under three, no. And here is still where they are in recent times. They have a grid of variables where no, maybe, yes. And on the grid is to the heart of what we do. If the parents have conflict, no. No overnights for young children below three. If they are working on it and somewhat improving, 4 or less a month. If they're getting along better, 5 or more. And so immediately, we're high conflict. Are they getting along? Are you kidding me? They haven't figured out yet that if they don't settle it, the judge is going to settle it. You know, are you crazy? Who wants that for your kids? So they haven't figured that out. Of course, they're going to say in Australia, no overnights for very young children. Right? So we have an anchor at that end. With Warshak, Rick Warshak is in Texas, and he is a prolific researcher on family law issues. he came out with a paper a couple of years ago on a consensus report on very young children and overnights. 100+ developmental, clinical, forensic people signed off from around the world saying the consensus is not a problem as long as you have reasonably capable parents. Not a problem whatsoever. At which point, of course, McIntosh and Pruitt and Kelly and others begin to go, oh, just a doggone minute, there is a problem. And so there's a real spirited debate about this, which I love came to a head recently with Bill Fabricius in Arizona. I was in a seminar he held a few years ago and talked to him. And at that point in time, he was putting together pieces for the article that I think I included for you. Here's what the article says. The level of conflict between the parents makes no difference in the ultimate outcome for the children. It absolutely does not. In fact, if it's high conflict and you have more parental time with both parents, the outcome is actually better, number one. Number two, the role of the mother is minimal. The role of the father is extensive. Predicting in teen years better educational output, better educational adjustment, social adjustment, and emotional adjustment. Go figure. Counter to everything that you would probably hear in most courts in Idaho today. Now, if you have a dad who's a deadbeat and doesn't care about kids, and you have a mom who, you could take it either way. And that's the last point. All of the researchers will tell you, we do research, do not apply the strange situation to your case. Do not apply Warshak's 100+ consensus report to your case. Do not apply Marsha Pruitt's information to your case. Your case is unique. We do research. You cannot extrapolate that over directly to your case. You have to look at this is your case with these kids at this point in time, end of discussion. However, if you don't know what the research is, now we go back to the rules of evidence in Idaho. As the expert, you are to bring before the court information that they would otherwise not ordinarily have access to. That's why you're the expert. So I couldn't go in and go, well, I've been around kids a long time, and I've seen some really doggone good dads, by golly. And I do believe that if we had those dads just have a half a chance, a little bit of help, and show them, the ropes, they'd be great dads. Ipsy dixit, there's no expertise in it. But if somebody said, on what basis are you saying that the father should have overnight in this case? Well, I can tell you that there's research that is not directly applicable to any case, but there's research that indicates that the outcomes socially, emotionally, intellectually in teen years is far better for children when they have overnight times with both parents, and that includes a father, and that the outcomes are also reported by those children. That's really how they got the results in this type of research at this point in time. And that in this particular case, looking at dad, he is a willing parent. I can see that he has parenting competencies from observation of him with the infants. I've asked him about his understanding. He seems to have understanding of different levels of Gerber baby food. And there are. And I talked to mom. She's a capable mom. And the same thing. They just don't like each other. And to that end, I really think this would be a good case for for this to take place. So now you have some information the court didn't know. And that's part of what our job is to educate the court. All right? That surprise anybody? Surprised me when I first heard it a few years ago.
What surprises me, and I'm wondering how you do this, but is the part about not referring or putting any research in. Explain to me the difference on that, because I'll let me think on you for a second, and maybe I'm not understanding, but like that sample report, you cited all sorts of research.
I did.
So tell me what you mean by saying, help clarify the difference.
I've changed my use of research and reports in the last few years. First of all, I'll tell you that it's very rare when I see anybody cite any research at all, and that includes Texas, Ohio, wherever. To my knowledge, outside of one other person in Texas, I've never seen research cited. However, it is in the model standards and guidelines between AFCC, APA, etc. Okay? And also, if you look at it in terms of expertise, if you want to go before the court for a Daubert hearing, do you know what a Daubert hearing is? right? Is this information, does it meet a standard? Does it, so forth and so on. If I don't have any research in there, again, we're kind of back to Ipsy-Dixit, you know? And so what I have now is I have relevant literature. That's what I call it. At one point, I was citing stuff more in the body, and it's like, you know, this is going to bite me. Somebody who really is good is going to come up and go, "Well, Dr. Davidson, you're citing Richard, you know, Warshak in 2015. You know, what relevance does this have to have anything? You know, he was talking to American Indians, and they swaddled their babies instead of, right? Well, but they were well adjusted. Come on, Judge, you know, we only have so much to work with here." And so I thought, well, that's kind of thin. And so what I'm putting now is relevant literature. Here is material that I think has what I would call a probity value. A probity value means that it has some value that carries weight for the relevant issue. Am I saying that it is tightly connected, you know, joint to joint? No. But on the other hand, if you want me to be the expert, and that's what you appointed me to be, Your Honor, this is what there is in the field to my knowledge. And the alternative would be to go back to Bubba and Ruth Ann.
So would your report say something like, according to recent literature or, you know, relevant literature, blah, 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 a little brief statement, and then you, do you
I would probably...
your relevant literature page, or do you just kind of...
You could say it, and there's nothing wrong in saying it. I don't, and I'll tell you why. I am trying to write a report that is very pithy, P-I-T-H-Y, a report that is brief and to the point. So most of my custody reports are somewhere in the 30-page range, including probably 3 pages or 4 of parenting time recommendations. And so to that end, I figure if I get called to testify and you ask me, you know, what basis are you making this recommendation? Then I can tell you. So I'm just trying to save the slogan according to research. And that's, I'm just kind of going as presumptuous.
And then that particular research that's in your mind when you write that statement is on that relevant research list in the back.
Yes, it is. And that's where, again, as the expert, if you get called to testify and you've made some statements that you think are going to be out of sync with the custody traditions of the court, you should be prepared. You know, if I went in and said, you know, well, Mom's got a drug habit with oxycodones and Vicodin, you know, she really should be in treatment, I'm not going to probably get questioned by anybody on that. You know, that's probably going to be well accepted. But if I go in and say, well, I think that Dad should have 3 overnights a week, you know, with the 20-month-old, you know that's going to get questioned. Fair enough? Okay. So let's go over best practices. This and the next slide will really be the kinds of things that I run into. First of all, it's important to remember in what you're doing as forensic evaluators, you're always looking, always, 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 always at functional behavior. Do not get sidetracked into looking at theories. Do not get sidetracked into looking at anything but what do I observe is this person's behavior, not a diagnosis, not a label, not a disrupted attachment. What's their behavior? If you can't describe the behavior so a sixth grader can get it, you're just going to put paint on a pig's ear, so to speak. You know, you're going to call it something fancy, and maybe you'll get away with it, but nobody will know exactly what that is. But for example, in a custody case a few years ago, the mother was taking the child into hospitals regularly for one ailment or another, kind of approaching Munchausen by proxy. And the hospital notes were beginning to reflect, we believe Mom's bringing this kid in here needlessly and is endangering this child. So they had a custody evaluation. And the mother was saying, Dad gives this kid Bass with lye in it and is burning him because he has red marks on him. And Dad also has some sort of ritual. I forget what it was called, but like a butt touch, right? Doing like touching this little boy's butt. He was like 6. And so, all right, I'm not going to probably get over to the dad's house to catch him putting lye in the bathtub. That's going to be tough. But there's no report medically of any problem there whatsoever. There's no CPS report of anything there whatsoever. So I talked to the kid. You know, well, your mommy's saying that sometimes you take a bath and tell me, is a bath like any bath, or is there something unusual about it? No, it's just a regular bath with my daddy. He put soap in, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, okay. Well, does it ever sting? No. You ever feel burned or like hot? Well, the water's hot, but I don't know. And, well, then he talks something about your bottom. Oh, mommy calls it a butt touch. He never does that. She always just says that. She's just trying to get him in trouble. I mean, sometimes you just get handed it on a platter, right? And it's functional behavior. So you already heard this phrase, comparative custodial fitness to the needs of a specific child, right, or children. And in a report, you should be looking at what are the parent factors therefore, and what are the child factors therefore. And so, for example, I've gone through at different times and looked at parent factors and child factors in the various learned treatises, books, and also just what you would expect in thinking about this. And if I can pull it up real quickly, I'll try to give you an example of what some of those factors would be. And again, I don't have a problem in sharing anything, but I think the way I present it is probably a bit different than what people have seen. I think, Mikhail, is that right from what you've seen? Yeah. So when I get to this part of the report, what I actually have, if it will open, there we go. What I actually have is I end up having a comparison between the parents on different factors. And that's why it's called comparative custodial fitness. And comparative custodial fitness is language from the American Psychological Association guidelines, for what it's worth. So it's not just coming out of my left ear. And so under the discussion, there'd be critical parent factors of present and past concerns. And so one area with a bunch of factors under it is parenting intelligence. Perceives a child's needs, a positive bond to the child, provides appropriate child care, provides appropriate child discipline, meets child's emotional needs, meets child's social needs, meets child's physical needs. And I make it clear in this particular section, a fair amount of what I'm talking about here is observation and clinical judgment at this point. I can't test for this or whatever. Another parenting area is parenting judgment, more factors. Emotional intelligence, more factors. Parents' relationship with the other parent, more factors. Communication skills, more factors. Living arrangement, more factors. Risk factors for the parents, substance abuse, emotional abuse, alcohol, whatever. Child special needs. So those are all parent factors, and then I turn to child factors. Attachment and bonding, emotional needs, cognitive needs, social needs, physical needs, a bunch of stuff under everything. And then a section on the fit of the child and the parents. Kind of see how logically it flows, but do you see how the law drives the scope of the report, drives what's going to be in the report somewhat in terms of the areas you'll cover by the model standards and guidelines, with the best interest factors in part being embedded in the parent and child factors, and research and knowledge in the field of child development, etc., driving parent and child factors. So we have the fit of the child and the parents, and then we culminate it with best interests of the child factors, Idaho Code 32717, A, B, C, D, E. A judge in California said not too long ago what she really, really would like to have from forensic evaluators, because they'd like to have a report that please just tells us about the kid. We already got that the parents don't like each other. Tell us about the child and what their needs are. And if you make recommendations, don't have it be like a Christmas present. Report, 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 surprise! You know, here's a recommendation. It all needs to connect. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D, leads to recommendations, or opinions leads to recommendations. Make sense? So, we have comparative factors, then we have observation. With very young children, and I've done reports with very young children, but just as background, when I was in college a long time ago, I directed a preschool for a couple years. I also helped to set the infant toddler daycare licensing laws in Michigan in the very first model daycare center they had for infants and toddlers. So I have distant and recent hands-on experience with, with young children, you have to have extensive observation if you're going to evaluate families for very young children. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I mean multiple hours more than what you'd ever do with a 9, 10, 11, 12, 15-year-old. And that you would look at multiple times. So if I'm evaluating a family with a toddler or an infant, I would like to see what the bedtime routine is. I want to see them put the kid to bed. I want to see if the kid goes to bed. I want to see how they're feeding the kid. I want to see just some interaction. I want to see how they're doing exchanges, if they're still doing person-to-person. How do they buckle the kid in? I mean, I have seen half the time people not putting their kids in car seats correctly. How do the exchanges go? I've seen particularly with moms. Well, I'll see you soon. Bye, baby. Mommy loves you. It's not going to be long, honey. The dad's like, "Dear God." And the kid's now beginning to cry, right? So you need to have that, yes?
So how theoretically do you do that? Because obviously that's not feasible for us all the time in all these cases and stuff to, say, live at the home and see all these things. So how do you, ideally that would be nice to be able to do that, but how do you do that? The observation.
How do I actually do it?
Yeah, what is your practice to kind of do the observation?
Just what I'm saying. Martha, what time's your baby go to bed? We're presuming here that it's probably a family with very young children, not necessarily the age range. What time's your baby go to bed? 7:30. What time do you feed her? Well, I feed her about 6. Fine. You mind if I come over about 5:45? I'll just hang out until you can see how you do and put the kid to bed.
What about some of these cases, like you said, where one party lives in Pocatello and then the other? I mean, again, we've got circumstances that it's just not feasible to do all that on.
Well, here's the difference, I suppose. You know, in family court services, you're dealing a lot with people that are indigent and you don't have that flexible time and you'd like to have a life, on top of that. So I probably target the highest risk cases to try to do all this extra work on. But if it was in Pocatello and it really was a high risk case, I would probably see if I could find a colleague in Pocatello who could go observe for me if I can't go. It's not the ideal. But it's a whole lot better than saying, I saw Ruth Ann here in Boise, and, you know, by report, I understand that things are fine with the other parent. So I would find a way to try to get that information, because it's very, very telling.
No, you know, I agree. It's just, there's a lot of extenuating circumstances in all these cases.
It is. It's a mess. I remember being at some people's houses where I'm ready to get in bed with a kid. I seriously am. But I'd look at the key times. And I would look at the circumstances, like I have mealtimes, bedtime, exchanges, and transport. And so, for example, at mealtimes and in bedtimes, I had a high-dollar, high-conflict case. And so they had the money to pay for all this time. But the dad, when he had the kids, they were all three, were young, basically would take the toddler, the older toddler, and when he was at the table, give him an iPad while he's feeding the babies. And the kid now is just now all up into the iPad, period. Mom is bouncing back and forth doing everything with everybody. So if you look at comparative fitness, the mom really is shining. When it came time to put the kids to bed, at one point they all had paid caregivers putting kids to bed. 9 months goes by. Mom is doing it all by herself. I mean, she's just a rock star. And dad, basically, he literally said to me, "I don't see how she does it." And he has a caregiver for him. I got back to comparative custodial fitness. So those are times where you really see what's going on, right? So we have those factors. Objective measures. Have you ever heard of an instrument called the HOME by Betty Caldwell? HOME. It is a observational technique that was developed years ago, University of Arkansas. And it is better than nothing. It's actually used at times in child welfare circles to evaluate the interaction of young children with a parent for foster care or for safety care of kids. But it does have different criteria that at least give you a structure that's easily done in a custody evaluation. Those materials are available directly from I'm thinking it's University of Arkansas has a person assigned to it. But again, if you want to give me your name and tell me what you're interested in, I'll try to get you the resources on that. It's not very expensive. It's very simple. But if you're going into court and somebody says, well, on what basis do you have anything to say about these kids? I'm always very happy to say, well, I use a structured observational method. It's not the most robust in the world, but these are babies and they can't talk to you. And this is a technique that's been used in multiple settings, social services and otherwise, and the parents did fine with it. And then we have allocation of parenting time rules. There's no rules. You just can't have a rule on how much time this would be. And finally, guidance from other states. You can look at Arizona and you can look at Texas, and there's materials on in the statute on what might be guidance for this. Real quickly, because I know we're out of time. Can I take 5 minutes of your time? Or if you have to leave and keep going for a minute, what would you like to do? Keep going? Okay, this is the last slide. These are common problem areas. This is what I'll hear when someone's saying, overnights, don't do it. Number one, mom's breastfeeding. You know, she's breastfeeding. How dare you rip this child off of my breast to go to your house? And, of course, nobody mentions that she pumps, when she decides to go out somewhere, or that she could pump prolifically forever. But that is a very common thing you'll hear. Or, the poor woman's breastfeeding, why would you want to do it to her? Well, honestly, it's in the best interest of the kids, not her, isn't it? And so in the best interest of the kids, and you see that the impact later is very high if you have both parents involved in things like overnights. So pump, or what formula do you think we should look at? I don't mean to be cruel about that, but I'm just saying it's a straw dog. Because whenever I've heard people say, I'm breastfeeding, if you look at the backstory, as it suits them. You know, it's very much as it suits the mom. Stable environment. You know, if you put this kid with this guy, he's in an apartment, you know, or he's living with his parents, it's just not stable. He's probably going to move. Well, the relationship, I think the stability is going to be with the person more than the environment. Kids are pretty field independent in a lot of ways, you know, as long as you have a decent environment that's safe. Nesting. Have you ever dealt with cases where people are nesting? In nesting, the parents move in and out, the kid stays in the home. I see that sometimes being practical for a few months if the parents need to get their own places, get the money together, get situated. But in one case, they've been nesting for a year and a half. You know, he's in my stuff. She took my thing. My diapers were used by her. It doesn't work really well, in my opinion. Prolonged exchanges. We already talked about the teary goodbye and how that just puts kids right in the middle. Reliance on screens for babysitting. I've seen this a lot. And this was any family. Oh, the kid's crying. Oh, sorry, Irma, I hit the phone you're on. They take the phone and just put it in the kid's hand to buy time. I understand that it's very powerful and that kids respond to that, but if you find that that is the go-to caregiver in a family, that's something that really should be addressed. Parental nudity often comes up, and it usually comes up in what circumstance? Dad is nude, and we have a 4-year-old daughter. You know, if she would see him and the wherewithal, it's going to probably scar her for life, and she will be precocious sexually. Well, the bottom line is it probably depends on how somebody's nude and what he or she is doing walking around nude. But if somebody's gotten out of the shower and the kid comes in running with their book, I don't think that's a big deal. If dad sits a kid down in the shower with him, then I would be like, you know, who's getting what out of this? Make sense? And then allegations of abuse. I don't have one up there. I should put up there. Allegations of abuse. It's not unusual in these kind of cases that... Often with a very dependent and somewhat impaired mother, I think dad needs to have supervised visitation. Why? Well, because he's abusive. Well, what's he done? Well, he's been harsh, and I think might have pinched him once or her. Well, is there any record of it? No, but he is abusive, you'll see. And so you'll have that kind of abuse, or, well, I think he's touching her now. There's nothing concrete with it. There's no CPS, you know, involvement. But you'll hear this kind of stuff thrown out for why there should not be any overnights. The last area that often comes up is co-sleeping. And they're sleeping together. They're 3 years old now. And at that point, that's a tough one. I mean, in some cultures and in some parts of the country or religions even, co-sleeping is a given. It's not a big deal. Depending on how much money in bed you have, co-sleeping is a given, especially if you're in transition. But you'll hear that sometimes as an objection to all of this. So what are your thoughts about infants, toddlers, very young children, overnights, trying to ferret this stuff out and deal with it?
My question, I guess, would be, and it goes back to, the rising tide raises all boats. How would you change the culture based on that belief in Idaho? Because that's been my experience with those, whether it's clients, judges, attorneys, have this sense that dads should not have overnight to very young children. Is it just via your expert testimony that hopefully that, there becomes a sense that it's a little different than people believe?
I think you have expert testimony. I think you have family court service people that have an access to judges.
Which I forwarded but I sent that article to all of our judges, and I had one call me the other day and ask me about it.
So I think you educate the gatekeepers, Mary, Michaela, Jennifer, and Jessica, I'm sorry. And I'll get it right. And Austin and Renee. I think you educate the gatekeepers. I think it's useful if you are inclined to throw a blog on your website, if you have a website. I write them when I get a chance. But I'll have an attorney that doesn't know me call up, and they'll go, I was reading your blog. And it's like, well, they're getting educated some. I think it's always room to offer to court services or to the bar continuing legal education. So there's no reason, for example, that several can't get together and say we'd like to do a presentation at one of the conferences on family law on very young children. I'm just going to call it very young children and overnight. And you'll have attorneys show up for that. So there's a multitude of ways that you can do that. I'm not sure. I think there's an Idaho Law Review. Is that correct? Idaho Law Review is a... Yeah, so you could write an article for the Idaho Law Review, forensic mental health and changing information on very young children. I'm sure that would get a good audience. People are you have to understand that the average attorney, in my opinion, is very well-intentioned, terribly overworked. I mean, I might have 2,000 pages for a case. They got 10,000 pages or 20. I mean, they have far more information than I'm dealing with. And so to sit down and go, let's just have a little casual talk here and let me bring you up to speed, they just want to go home, And so to that end, I think that they would be happy if you could find ways that would give it to them that they can digest with the time that they have. I had a person at the Brown Bag lunch in Boise a few weeks ago. A lawyer came up and said, well, look, I just want to ask you a question because I've never understood this. So what's this, parent-child, what are you guys doing? How do you guys do this? And I said, well, it's the comparative custodial fitness of the parents and the child's needs. Oh, so you're comparing the mother and the father and how they are with the needs of the kid. Exactly. Well, that's clear. I never guess I quite got that. I mean, that is not going to be uncommon. It's just not. So there's a lot of ways to kind of deliver the goods. What else is anybody else thinking?
Can we see you all the time?
Thank you.
Yeah, I will say, this has been really exciting, actually. Yeah. Just so much information, and I appreciate being able to...